This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One. I'm Greta Mart.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Come along and join Associate Producer Lori McCandish King as she visits with Linda Watanabe McFerrin about McFerrin's new book, Navigating the Divide. McFerrin is an acclaimed travel writer, poet, and novelist with a special talent for creating a sense of place in her work. The two discuss the personality of place, the attraction of risk, and the boundaries between good and evil.
Lori McCandish King, reporting from Puerto Madera in Northern California. I'm talking with Linda Watanabe McFerrin, travel writer, poet, and novelist, about her new book, Navigating the Divide. I think the best way to introduce Linda is with a little bit from the foreword of this book. Linda is the founder of the immensely popular Left Coast Writers Group, which meets at Book Passage Bookstore, as a beloved teacher whose workshops are regularly oversubscribed, and as a mentor to dozens of successful and grateful authors of best-selling and award-winning books. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you, Lori. It's wonderful to be here on this podcast with you.
Navigating the Divide is a collection of pieces of your writing, poetry, travel writing, short stories, a novel. What does the divide refer to?
Well, before we go into that, I just want to do a little explanation about the book and about Alan Squire Publishing, my publisher. This is the third book in their Legacy series. And what they try to do in that series is select writers whose work crosses genres, hence Navigating the Divide in my case, and also writers who work with a lot of different other writers and help mentor them into a successful career or a successful production of work.
Which you have really done. You've mentored New York Times best-selling authors.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
I'm grateful for that. I've been really lucky because I work here in the Bay Area where there are tremendous writers who are working all the time, and lucky enough to have had an opportunity to work with some of them. Jasmine Darznik is a wonderful writer. For Navigating the Divide, Allison Wright, who wrote Learning to Breathe, is another person I've been able to work with. You know that because we've edited a lot of people together
over
the years. And it's been a fun process.
It's been great fun.
We have a really lively and vibrant community here of writers. So very fortunate. Some of that is just place. It's being in the right place at the right time. But then also being the kind of person who has to edit everything. There's that T-shirt that we saw that said, "I'm editing you while you speak." So
I just saw another one. It's Grammar Police on the front, and then on the back, to serve and correct.
Oh, I love to serve and correct. Yes, I think that's a great mantra, or it's a great slogan. Absolutely. So that's what the book is about. So Navigating the Divide is actually something that I've been doing since I was a little kid, traveling all over the world. It's really crossing the boundaries of place, primarily for me originally, and culture as part of my heritage. It's multicultural, but also of good and evil, the real and the surreal. So there are a lot of boundaries that need to be crossed, genres, ways of thinking, cultural boundaries, and threading a way through all of those, I think, is a very exciting place to be.
A lot of the stories in here are about place, whether they're specifically travel stories or not. For example, your novel, Dead Love, takes place in several parts of Asia. Oh, actually, all around the world, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's also
Amsterdam as well.
Mm-hmm. And does it go to Haiti?
It does go to Haiti.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a particularly good way of bringing a sense of place into all of your work, even if it isn't particularly travel writing.
Place for me has a personality. It's almost like a character. And I think that comes across in all of my work. I'm glad that you mentioned the Dead Love book, which is about the zombies, which takes place all over the world, because that's kind of like my life has taken place. And
thought you were going to say that's where zombies are.
Childhood.
All around the world.
They are everywhere. Zombies are everywhere. They're at the coffee shop that you go to in the morning, and they're at the bar you go to at night. place is very, very important to all of my work. I do think it has a personality. For example, in Dead Love, I originally had planned to set that, and I wrote a lot of it, where the insane asylum is actually based on a real asylum in Switzerland, and Ping is actually a Swiss friend of mine.
Oh, my.
So I went for a long time with that setting, and then I realized that you can't have zombies in Switzerland.
It doesn't really work.
It doesn't work. Mm. So I moved them to Tokyo, which seemed a much better place, and then to Malaysia, which seemed even better for the setting. So it's interesting. I do think that certain places have a personality, and they beg to have things set in them.
So let's have a little excerpt of one of your pieces that talks about travel or about place.
I guess the opening of Shanghai by the Past is one of my favorite openings because it really does describe a place. Some call Shanghai the Pearl of the Orient. In many ways it is. Organic, iridescent, a nacreous gemstone wrapped around a suffering center stuffed into the belly button of China. Behind it, China's umbilicus, the great Yangtze, crawls through the fat middle of the country all the way from Tibet. Shanghai is young as great cities go, a murky backwater for centuries. Its origins as a cosmopolitan center are rooted in the 1843 Treaty of Nanjing and trade war concessions won by the British in the ignominious Opium Wars, which allowed British merchants to continue to pollute the Chinese populace. So I think that is the idea of Shanghai and its personality having a lot to do with where it is located at the very end of the Yangtze River, where it dumps into the sea, is something about the personality of Shanghai and what happens with it. So I like to think of a place as having a personality. And communism changed Shanghai, but only for a while. The city comes back as vital and as Shanghaiese as ever. There's a personality, just like Paris has a personality, mm-hmm. which is very different from the personality of Prague or of Rome. All these cities have their own. Tokyo has its own personality. New York has a personality. And I think those personalities are grounded in the things that have happened there, very much like our personalities as human beings are grounded in the experiences we have as children.
So how do you get a sense of the personality of a place?
Oh, that's a really good question. For me, I kind of feel it when I go into the place. It's something in the way, is it a busy place? Is it rushed? What's the tempo? What's the energy? What are the iconic things that represent a particular place? When I go to Tokyo, I think of pachinko, that bing, 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 the sound of those mm-hmm. in Shibuya, the little things going down through the pachinko machines, this fast-paced, crazy-paced sort of sound. Sometimes it's associated with the sound of the place. It might be the sea quietly lapping up on the nearby seashore. A lot of it has to do with geography, probably.
And history. Do you read up on the history of a place before you go or before you write about it?
Well, I like to know about the place in general and what its history is because that can open. What it does is create a series of doors that you may or may not go through. Mm-hmm. I don't like to choose one door. So all the historical elements might be a door that you might turn the doorknob and walk through. I don't pick the door until I get to the place. And my selection is very personally triggered. It's not something that comes in advance of the experience. Mm-hmm. So most of my work's super personal and about my reaction to a place and what I feel I can speak to. I'll do some research, but I don't like going in with a preconceived idea of what I'm going to write about because I never know what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. So I'm always on a quest and trying to find something rather than trying to locate something that I think is there. So that's the fun way to write about something, I think, or to explore a place, is with an open mind, as open as possible. Yet you should know sort of where you're going and what kind of shoes to pack. Because you want to get around. I mean, you don't want to be wearing your flip-flops in the middle of a swamp.
I know, but you want to look good, too.
Well, there is that. There's always that.
And you want to fit in. How important is it to fit in?
Oh, I don't think we fit in when we travel to a foreign country. I don't think we fit in when we go most places. I don't fit in at home. I don't think it's important to fit in at all. I think it's important to be who you are, to represent yourself. We are our own places, really. I think you go as a certain place and person to these other places, and you bring something to it as well. You don't just take. One of the things about traditional tourism that I find appalling is this whole concept of how much can you take home with you? I think what's always more important in travel is what you leave behind. It's the impression that you give the people that you meet, what gifts you exchange with them. It's always an interchange. Bringing your true self to a place, whatever that identity is really, really important. And it may be the loud floral you. It just depends on, you know, it depends on the kind of person you are. So your packing is always really dependent on your personality. That said, I generally like to pack things that are pretty basic because for me, my personality, I get distracted by anything that overwhelms or that takes away from the moment. And sometimes clothing can do that. It's very distracting. But different personalities deal with it differently. I have a pretty compulsive sort of personality that gets easily distracted by things. Because little things will fascinate me. And if I'm distracted by something else, I don't notice those little tiny things that I want to focus on and I want to concentrate on.
And that attention to detail and noticing the little things that make one place different than another or that characterize a particular person are part of what makes writing really effective.
Yeah.
Do you have a piece you could read?
Here's a little selection from The Lore of Hoodoos, which takes place in Sedona, Arizona. It was a travel piece that I wrote. Sideshows and extravaganzas. We were ready to meet Sedona head-on, but like any good scouts, we first opted to explore our more immediate surroundings. We had to walk down the hillside into Oak Creek Canyon and discover the source of that sound. The rattling rose and fell around us on our short descent into the canyon. The fat faces of daisies gazed up at us. June bugs as big as hummingbirds buzzed us. It grew cooler as we crossed the creek. Irises grew in the small patches of shadow. Oak Creek was so clear that we could see the flat gray-green rocks resting like turtles beneath the water on the opposite side. Ducks cut slow ciphers into the water's glassy surface. I began to feel drowsy. That's when I met it, my first denizen of the desert. I came face to face with a fat grasshopper with leopard markings and pearl-gray eyes at the top of its head. It was clinging to one of the green rushes at the side of the creek that cut through the canyon, and it was staring at me, its thorax heaving. I bent closer until it was inches away from my cheek. Clearly, this was one of those monumental meetings in which creatures from disparate worlds connect spiritually and exchange greetings.
I love that.
You would. It's about grasshoppers and nature. Right, and interesting creatures.
It's not only that. There's something really appealing to me about the way you connect with those creatures.
Thanks. I think I've been doing that ever since I was a little girl. When I was 4, we moved to England and lived in the countryside in Wiltshire, and it was so beautiful. There were blackberry hedges and bumblebees and big fat fields of clover, big purple clover, and delightful slugs and caterpillars. And I was pretty much free. It was a pretty safe world. I was free to sort of wander around this kind of rural setting and collect my little specimens and study them. And I really loved it. So I have this sort of rapport with nature and the sense of this almost hallucinatory love of our surroundings. It's really a kaleidoscopic, incredible environment that we live in.
Okay, so you have to read the part from Namako Sea Cucumber.
So this is the selection when Ellen, the main character, who's a young kid in a science class, first sees a sea cucumber and is so fascinated by it, which kind of is like my fascination with all things in nature. So it begins, I walked over to the windows. The late sun had cast them in bright topaz. I picked up the box that Anne had been standing on earlier. I'm going to draw one of these, I said, scrupulously positioning the box at the foot of one of the lockers. I had to stand on tiptoe to reach the particular jar. I climbed down cautiously,
mindful not to slip or drop it. I had selected it long ago when it had made a brief appearance during a lecture on phalangerates. It was my favorite creature. The jar seemed to have a life of its own. It threatened to slide from my hands. I walked over to one of the lab tables and set the glass container on top of it, surprised that the hand that had gripped it was not wet. Had I imagined a wetness? The brown thing in the jar looked like a long pouch, fringed at the mouth with whisker-like tentacles. "This is a sea cucumber," I said. "It's an animal. Doesn't it look like a vegetable, though? It's even named for vegetable. It must be horrible to be so strange that nobody knows what you really are." Anne leaned close to the jar in which the cucumber dangled quiescently, so close that her long lashes appeared to brush the glass. Next to the embalmed form, her face looked pale, like a small moon. "It's so awful looking," she murmured, with a hushed appreciation generally reserved for only the holiest things in church. "What are you going to do with it?" "I'm taking it home with me," I reported with great satisfaction.
One of the things that makes your writing so engaging is the way you push out there. You take risks, you expose your own vulnerability. And that's common in fiction and poetry, but you even do that in travel essays. I'm thinking of Lost in the Okefenokee, where you had to maneuver your canoe past a 14-foot alligator in a narrow channel. Or that one, Running the Lion City Hash. In that one, we, the reader, discover, along with you, near the end of the story, that you're in danger. You write, "Suddenly everything became clear. I'd been invited to run as a sacrifice."
Hmm. Right.
"I feared for your physical safety."
So did I.
When I read those stories, they just sucked me in. There's so much emotion in them. Mm-hmm. And even though those were physically dangerous situations, but you're even more exposed when you reveal emotional vulnerability. And I'm interested in the way you identify and amplify what's at stake in each story. That's something that I think you do particularly well.
Well, thank you. I think it's based on life, actually. I think that great stories, good literature, things that pull us in are based on risk mm-hmm. and being at risk. And the wonderful thing about the page is that you can be at risk and not lose your life. It's a great place to work things out. And some of my best memories, some of my most intense memories, and I think this is for everybody, are the times when we're at risk. And I also think it's very important to be able to look at that risk and to be able to find out what is so meaningful about it. And I'm pretty good at putting people at risk in my books and characters at risk because I've been at risk for, you know, my whole life. My mother, when I was a little girl, 4 years old, would say, "Okay, here's where you're supposed to go, go," and put me on the bus. And I would sometimes end up at the end of the line at a terminal or something, and the bus driver would say, "Well, what stop were you supposed to get off at?" Those were times when it was a little bit safer, though I don't really know how safe it was, and I have always felt at risk. Namako's sea cucumber piece is interesting because Namako means raw child, and it is really about being exposed and being neither of the sea nor of neither this nor
Namako
that.
Namako means raw child?
Yeah, Namako.
Why is there a term for raw child?
I don't know. It's Nama, raw, and then ko means child. It's an exposed creature, and so it's a very neither of the land nor of the sea kind of creature. And so I felt it was a really important symbol for that betwixt and between kind of thing that I write about a lot. It's not an attractive creature, which is a risk in itself, right? It's really, really very important to me, and I do put a lot of risk into my work. And I think people are attracted to that because they can follow it to a point. And in some places, in the novels, it gets really, really bad. Mm-hmm. You know, people do die. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, main characters die, which is unfortunate and probably not a great decision on the part of the writer.
Well, you keep them in a zombie, so
right.
You don't lose
they
them
do
completely.
Get reborn. That's true. They come back.
That risk-taking, Linda, and the insistence on pushing the boundaries are especially apparent when you move into surrealism and reptiles. You have a thing about reptiles.
I do. I love reptiles.
in addition to the Okefenokee alligators, there's that poem, The Dragon. And then there's On the San Joaquin, your Kafkaesque story about being bitten by an iguana.
Right. I have a fondness for anything that people don't like. This is the part about pushing the boundaries between what is good and evil, what is loved and despised. I think that there's an energy in between those two, that space in between, and it's very important to acknowledge that space. I think they're two sides of a coin, and I think it's important for us to love the other as much as we love what's ourselves, because so often we are the other, and to somebody else we are the other. So that understanding that the two are the same, that if you're a snake, you're not scary to yourself. You're scary to somebody else, and largely that comes from misunderstanding or not knowing what the center of that snake's world is. So I just like inhabiting other things that might be considered evil, because there's a big, it's very, very important to realize that there's no good, there's no evil. There's just the way we manage our relationship with those things. So that's a big part of what I write about. And so much of what goes wrong in the world is because we divide things up and we don't try to bring things together more or look at the similarities rather than the differences. And when we encounter other cultures, very much the same thing. It's about finding where we have a point of union rather than a place where we're separated and where we're different. So I have this poem, Strangers, mm-hmm. or Stranger, that I'd like to read.
Good.
I also have a story by the same name in the book. But the poems are usually a language that is less diluted, that's very, very intense, and so you can get the message across really quickly. So this poem is Stranger. Strangers intoxicate me when too close. The current of their lives streams into mine. Friend or foe, I want to let them in. You I have met before, staggering under the impulse of acquaintance. Lines of composition, my eye traces the path of your egress. The sparsity of our communion beckons. Trying to push flesh into flesh, thrusting toward a moment that crumbles, disintegrates before it can complete, suggesting only that other entering when all the outlines are erased. And I think that's what we strive for, that place where we connect on a spiritual level, where we connect as human beings, as creatures that have so much in common, because we're all basically lab rats in the great evolutionary experiment, which is what we are. Our success or failure is just part of a big experiment.
Thank you so much for your time, Linda. I've read the book and I absolutely love it. It's stunningly beautiful. And I'm looking forward to rereading it, as a matter of fact.
Oh, thanks. It's diverse. It's the kind of thing that's meant not necessarily to be read from cover to cover, but to be picked up and
Yeah, I love
enjoy.
That about it. You can just pick up a little piece of
right,
it. Yeah,
right.
It's really nice.
So little bits. It was fun chatting with you, Lori.
Yay. We'll do it another time.
We should do it again.
You've been listening to Lori McCandish King interviewing author Linda Watanabe McFerrin.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org.